Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's July 2nd. KPCW celebrating its 44th birthday today. Happy birthday, KPCW. We've got 53 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City, 56 degrees in Heber City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Happy birthday, KPCW. It's my boy's 7th birthday today, so lots to celebrate. Hey, and it's a great weather day as well. Yesterday we had all the wind, some of the clouds, even a few sprinkles through Park City. Temperatures near 73 today, mostly sunshine. Light winds today as well. Should be just phenomenal temperatures and weather. Cooler than average thanks to the northwest flow that's in place following yesterday's front. In Heber, a high of 80 with plenty of sunshine. Over the next several days, not much change temperature-wise. In fact, with northwest flow staying in play, a few storms passing to the east of us, it's going to keep us in the 70s for daytime highs. Wednesday in Park City, 78 tomorrow, 76 on Independence Day. And on Friday, we'll start to warm up. High pressure is going to start to inch closer as it builds in from the west to east, 81 on Friday. Sunshine all the way through the rest of the week. So really plans outdoors for the 4th of July should be pretty pristine right now with those comfortable temperatures. Climbing over the weekend, though, high pressure will be situated over top of us, meaning we'll see highs in the mid-80s on Saturday. Sunday, similarly, 87 with highs almost to 90 by Monday into next week. No chance of moisture in the next 5 to 7 days. Things are looking really quiet that way. So for Heber, we'll see that warm up in temperatures as well by the end of the week, the weekend. Otherwise, we're in the mid-80s for the next several days, about 89 on Friday. Low to mid-90s over the weekend with 96 and sunshine Monday next week.
Okay, Nate, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybrow with a preview of this week's county council meeting. Summit County Clubhouse Executive Director Jen O'Brien will be joined by a member of the clubhouse. They'll have an update on some club activities as well as their upcoming fundraiser. And finally, the director of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, discussing open space issues, including the update on their conservation burial plans. Taking a look at some local news now, the United States Nordic Combined Program has lost funding for its training and coaching amid bankruptcy concerns. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports that a new nonprofit now aims to fill that gap.
USA Nordic announced its partnership with the Norwegian ski jumping team is ending, canceling the four-year agreement only 2 years in. The ski jumping government bodies from the U.S. and Norway forged an unprecedented partnership in 2022 to share coaches, training facilities, and attract sponsors. The sport of Nordic combined encompasses both ski jumping and cross-country skiing. After falling short of a $150,000 funding goal, USA Nordic's board of directors last week moved to financially split the disciplines. Board Chairman Tom Bickner said the Nordic combined program struggles to bring in sponsors and revenue. Steven Schumann, a Park City Nordic combined athlete on the 2022 Olympic team, said the board's move is a major blow to the program.
They essentially took what little support and funding we had, got rid of it, and told us, you guys are on your own. You need to find your own way if you want to make this work. And so that is what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to show them that we can do it without them, and that we have the support of our communities and the world to excel over the next few years.
In response to the news, former Olympians including Billy DeMong, Johnny Spillane, and Taylor Fletcher have joined forces with athletes and their parents to create a new nonprofit to revive the sport. Schumann said the funds raised by the nonprofit would help the U.S. Nordic combined program at all levels, from bringing in coaches to finding wax technicians and buying new equipment.
As of right now, we have one coach that was working with us that's based in the United States. He's based in Park City. But other than that, we don't really have coaching. We don't have a whole lot of organization behind us. So we're kind of trying to set up this new nonprofit to try to fundraise so that we can move forward with the Norwegian system and continue to work with them to try to reach the top level.
The U.S. Nordic combined team had one of its best seasons in recent history last winter, with Schumann and four other athletes landing in the top 30 World Cup standings. Members of the new nonprofit are in Steamboat, Colorado this week to begin fundraising efforts at the annual 4th of July ski jumping competition. Schumann said they hope to also raise awareness about the passion for Nordic combined worldwide as the International Olympic Committee considers cutting the event for the 2030 Winter Games. More information about the new nonprofit can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from Wasatch County, I have County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
So it's a busy holiday week, but you decided to meet anyway?
Yeah. We got a lot of things to do, so we'll keep it going.
Yeah, so you've got a quorum then?
Yes.
All right. First up is the transit tax. That's on tomorrow's agenda, a resolution that would enact the imposition of a local sales and use tax for both public safety and transit. So what's being proposed here?
So this year, the state legislature amended one of the currently existing transit sales taxes. Now, for those of the listeners who aren't aware, there are five different options for transit sales taxes. Back in 2022, Wasatch County enacted our first, and that's what launched our partnership with High Valley Transit. We're looking at the possibility of implementing a second transit sales tax, and the one that we have picked is the one that was amended through this legislative session that allows for both public safety and transit uses. Right now, the draft resolution shows that we're suggesting a 25% allocation to public safety uses and the other remaining 75% towards transit. The things that we have talked about over the course of this year are funding paratransit, increased bus frequency, potentially better or additional microservice. And I know that there's a lot of interest in a Utah County connection, but we don't think we quite have enough funds yet to be able to make that connection, in addition to some of the other public safety improvements that we're working with the sheriff on to identify the best and highest and best use of those funds.
Yeah, so that's 25% that you can use for public safety, then would that free up money in the general fund for other uses if you're using the sales tax for public safety?
Yeah, so there is the possibility of us replacing some existing revenue sources with this, but I think the intent is to just make sure that we both address some of the policy priorities of the county council, which may be things that they have talked about are whether we're covering some things that we're currently charging cities for through this transit tax, or some council members have even suggested they'd be interested in lowering our property taxes and offset it using this revenue source instead. But I think it's also likely that we will end up funding additional public safety needs that we have, and whether that's additional patrol officers or in other areas, those are the types of things we're working with the sheriff on.
Mm-hmm. So maybe take a step back here and explain to us what this quarter system means for taxes.
So all of the transit taxes that are authorized by the state are sales taxes that don't apply to gas or groceries. These are general purchases at, you know, stores when you're buying goods that aren't just food, and they go into certain buckets that we have to use them on. And depending on which transit tax is available, they all add up to about a 1.25%. Dutch County has only implemented a single portion of that tax. It's a 0.25% sales tax, and it's funding our current microtransit service in the Heber Valley and the bus that connects between Heber City and Park City. So this additional portion of transit taxes would provide us additional funding to be able to do some of those things that I already mentioned.
Okay, so quarter refers to the percentages as opposed to quarters of the year.
Yeah, it can be confusing because there are five of them and they add up to 1.25%, but not all of them are exactly a quarter. So it can be a confusing nomenclature, but really we're just implementing portions of these transit sales taxes and prioritizing the funding to offset property tax payers potentially, as well as addressing local transit needs.
Okay, so my understanding is that first quarter, it's about 0.3%.
Correct.
And then what would the second quarter then add to that?
So I don't have the numbers in front of me. One of them is 0.2 and this first quarter is 0.3. The others end up being quarters, 0.25%. But each of them have kind of unique ways in which they're implemented and unique requirements of some of them are eligible to be used for more things than just transit. They can be used for transportation infrastructure or studies or other things like that.
Okay, so I guess that first quarter, you get more than the 0.25%. How does that happen?
That's just the dollar amounts or the percentage amounts that the state legislature has adopted. This is a transit sales tax that's already in place in Summit County and Park City. And actually, I believe all of them are in place in that area. So we're playing a little bit of catch up when it comes to our transit game. But really, it's all outlined in state code, and there's very little discretion given to us. It's more which, if any, is the county interested in implementing and then abiding by the restrictions the state sets for how to use them.
All right. Now, you mentioned increasing the paratransit. Isn't something like that covered with any federal dollars?
There are federal grants for things like that, and High Valley Transit takes advantage, I think, of as many federal programs as they need. There is actually not a huge expense for us. We have about a $200,000 estimated cost of implementing that paratransit, and I believe that's part of the benefit is that we would be able to get some help from the federal government.
All right. And then in terms of public comment, are you taking that at tomorrow's meeting?
Yeah, we do expect to have some robust feedback. I know the council, we have been discussing this basically all year long throughout as we've talked about service updates and timing of if and when we might implement an additional transit tax. So now is the time that we're bringing it back, primarily because we identified this first transit tax as the best funding option due to the public safety component, but its effective date started just yesterday.
All right. How much are we talking about? I mean, how much would this 0.2% or thereabouts raise every year?
So the 0.3 will generate about $3.6 million. So with a quarter of that being $900,000 for public safety and the remainder for transit purposes. We do have some other transit expenses that we're hoping to cover with this, and then also setting some aside to save for future capital needs related to transit, like a park and ride on other things like that.
All right. There's also a discussion tomorrow regarding the proposed 2025 county budget. I believe your fiscal year, though, is calendar, right? It's done January through December?
Correct. So you'll find most entities take a fair amount of time in developing those budgets. So this is really just the kickoff of our discussion of the 2025. And it really is relevant to our transit discussion because those transit X's would be implemented at the beginning of next year. And then as we prioritize the public safety improvements, the transit, and all of the other aspects of our budget, those will be some of the things that we're talking about as far as what is the timeline of when we'll be discussing with the council and bringing things back to them and making recommendations and making sure that we're including the public as much as the council wants to, and make sure the council has adequate transparency so they have confidence about what it is we're proposing as we approach 2025.
Mm-hmm. So what do you anticipate in terms of next year's budget? Is it going to require any kind of tax increase?
We don't expect that, no, actually. We are very early in the process. Mm-hmm. So what we're just talking about this week is really just the timeline of when we'll bring those things back. But no, we don't expect to request a truth and taxation hearing. We are in the position, actually, of being able to fund our courthouse expansion, which we are undertaking right now, entirely with just existing revenue sources and not having to raise property taxes or impact our property taxes. And a big chunk of that is honestly the increased revenues that we're seeing out of the MIDA project area. At Deer Valley East Village will end up being a really significant financial contributor to the county's budget and offset many of the impacts that might happen otherwise to the Heber Valley.
All right, there is also tomorrow a public hearing at 6 o'clock about a residential development in Sky Ridge for an additional 46 units. So what's the latest in that development?
So this is the development kind of just, the project starts close to the parkway, the Jordanelle Parkway, and then has kind of worked its side up the hill. So this project kind of is the bigger units on the north end of the development on that hill that is north of the Jordanelle Parkway.
Okay, any issues that are concerning to the county planners?
I don't think there's any major issues. I know one thing that they are requesting some extra approval on is some of the retaining walls that are in our code. We have limits on the length and height of those codes unless there is approval from the council. We have granted those already for this development in a different phase. I don't think that the council has a great deal of concern just because of the geography of the situation, kind of warrants those size and those placements. And it just ends up being a technical issue to make sure that we're doing those things in the safest way possible.
Okay. And then from last week's meeting, the council discussed some open space preservation. What was happening on that front?
So we actually had two items last week. We talked about both funding a conservation appraisal of a property. This is the Lundeen property, so it's on the west side of Midway. We've been working with them for, gosh, maybe it's been 2 years now, that the council has authorized $2 million of our bond funds to contribute to that project, but they've had some issues getting through the conservation easement approval process that I think we're now getting close to completing. But we wanted to get a more recent appraisal to make sure that we were complying with all the requirements that we had set and that the other federal and local agencies have. The other was that we had talked with council about issuing a letter of support for the rural communities program that would be able to heighten the level of federal funding availability for preservation in the Heber Valley and the surrounding areas. And so something that we're really excited to support. Many of the things that we were already doing would have qualified for this, but it's really only this newest project that, because we have already dedicated funding to those other ones, as new things come in, they will have this heightened priority at the federal level.
Okay, that's pretty easy. Support.
Yeah.
Yeah, I support and I'll take the money. Yeah.
Exactly, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, and then the TAP grants have been awarded. What are some of those projects with the trails and parks grants?
Yeah, so we awarded, I believe it was 13 different projects and about $275,000. There are some trails around the Wasatch Mountain State Park that we are contributing to. Some of that are the connections up to the Bonanza area down to the Wild Trail, the Bow Wow Trail. There are also some park improvements that we funded at Southfield Park, some additional pavilions, a number of arts programs that we've supported. And these are events that locals have put on. One of them is a charity that has largely been privately funded and gives all of their proceeds to charity. And so the county is contributing some funds at to be able to help it grow and help it become a more substantial contributor to those causes.
Okay. How much money does that 0.1% tax, sales tax raise each year?
So this year it's about $1.2 million. And we actually split it between Heber City, Midway City, and Wasatch County. We agreed when we implemented those taxes to share it based on population lines. So Wasatch County actually covers the unincorporated areas as well as the smaller municipalities. So we make sure that our TAP board has diverse representation from Wallsburg, Hideout, and other areas within the county to make sure that we're addressing all of those needs. And there is a Hideout project that we're funding, and we've already used these funds to also contribute to a trail in Wallsburg. And we just want to make sure that we're doing the most good with this.
Okay. And Heber City, I believe, receives the lion's share of that funding?
Yeah, they get about half of it, and the county gets about 30% of it, and then Midway gets about the remainder.
Okay. So all, it sounds like maybe then all that money was spent that was raised, the 1.2.
Yeah, so there is some that we're recommending to be saved. The TAP board recommended and the council agreed that we would set aside 10% for future projects, and that actually there is a surplus above that that they're recommending be applied to our next round of TAP tax grants. And so our intent is to do a semi-annual award so that we would be doing another award round in this next fall. And given that the county gets about $400,000 annually out of our portion of that 1.2, we'll be awarding on average something like $200,000 each of those cycles. This time, because it was implemented partway through last year, we had a little bit more funds than that available.
Got it. All right. And then two new public infrastructure districts were created for the Black Rock Mountain Resort and Wakara Ridge. Council discussed the public good to justify these so-called PIDs. So what's the public good being proposed in these projects?
I think with the Black Rock Resort, it's a little bit more clear in that there's a really unique venue there that has a really significant financial impact on the county. When the county first embarked down considering whether or not we would do PIDs, the commercial aspect was the one that clearly impacted all of our county residents, because these commercial projects that as they build and they develop and we collect tax revenues from them, those directly offset any property taxes or other tax sources that we need, and we're able to continue to deliver high quality services without having to go back and raise property taxes. So I think that combined with some of the potential amenities associated with the resort, I think was what maybe pushed over the line for the council. Wakara Ridge is a little bit different of a circumstance, particularly in the context of the state legislature. Again, this year passed bills around infrastructure financing districts. Now, these are largely identical to PIDs, but without any need for the county to provide input on the process. And we have actually already seen applications for two of these infrastructure financing districts. What we felt was that it was better to have a seat at the table when considering this potential funding source, knowing that they could go outside of our purview and get it anyways. So by going through this process, we're able to identify the ways that this financing source has the least impact to the potential future property owners. And the things that we've done to make sure is that there is really enhanced disclosure, so that if anyone buys those properties, they know transparently that this PID is in place and how it impacts them. And how it impacts them is also something that we wanted to make sure happened in a way that we were comfortable, which was funding the project at the time of a title transfer, so that there's no ongoing payment from those future property owners. They pay as they close on that property and ends up being a part of the purchase price.
Okay, and that's where I was going with this in terms of, we talk about the need for affordable housing. So how do these PIDs work when we talk about affordable housing? I mean, it just adds another level of payment for, I mean, again, they're paying off these bonds that the homeowners paying off these bonds that traditionally developers have had to raise capital for.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, developers build those costs into the purchase price one way or the other. And this area, I think it would be a rough, it does not really qualify as affordable housing, right? These are high-end housing units. And while there is a sizable impact from these PIDs, I think it ends up being, you know, relatively small compared to the market value of the properties that we're considering. So yeah, you're right in that it seems like there is an impact there, but I think it's gonna be through these infrastructure financing district that many of those other projects are gonna go. And I believe that the state at least feels like having easier access to lower interest rate funds might have a positive impact on the total cost of developing projects. And so I believe that's the impetus behind them creating those things to make sure that we do continue to build housing. But I think for this particular project, I wouldn't say it has a major impact on Wasatch County's affordable housing.
Okay, and what would make the county hesitate or deny a PID request?
So what we did is we set out a policy that outlined the criteria that we felt people needed to meet. And one of those criteria, particularly for these housing projects like Wakara Ridge, was that they must be in the Jordanelle Basin. I think that does a lot to make sure that the county has clearly communicated our expectations. So we have these enhanced disclosures, we have the requirement to pay it off at title transfer, and by geographically limiting it, we're hoping that this growth takes place in an area that has fewer local impacts to residents in the Heber Valley and other parts of the county. And really, this is the area where Wasatch County for many years has prioritized growth, because that area had historically not seen as many housing units. There is a lot of demand for housing there due to its proximity to Park City and Salt Lake. And so I think we have a good job of preemptively communicating those expectations, and we have filtered those applications as they come in against those expectations.
Okay. Finally, I wanted to bring up fire restrictions. Wasatch Back was actually kept out of the latest ban on open fires and fireworks. Things are certainly drying out, though. What should people be mindful of with the two July holidays coming up?
Yeah, we really just want people to make sure that when you are recreating with fireworks, that you're doing it in a responsible way and doing it in what we call the wildland urban interface. These are areas that are more wooded, kind of outside of the urban areas, and they're just not safe places to be doing fireworks. So if you are going to do fireworks, do them, come down into the Heber Valley, come to a place where there's less trees and less chance for major damages. And I believe that some of the cities have enacted their own restrictions or intend to enact their own restrictions about where and when and things like that. But really, we just want to make sure that everybody is able to celebrate these events, but do it in a safe way that doesn't have major impacts later.
Okay, Dustin, anything else you want to mention?
Not this morning.
All right. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow. Joining me now in the studio with an update from the Summit County Clubhouse, I have Executive Director Jen O'Brien. She's joined by one of the members of the clubhouse, Brent. So good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, Jen, maybe start with one of the topics, housing. It sounds that you've got some good news there.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to back up and just give a little context first for those who haven't heard of the Summit County Clubhouse. We are a community center of sorts run by and for people with mental health challenges. Members come when they need for what they need is voluntary, and they come for three different types of programming. One is to be engaged in productive work, really, the work of running the clubhouse. The second is to be to develop meaningful relationships through our social programming. And the third is to get direct support in areas of education, employment, and housing. And so housing has been a frustration, really, for us since I started in September, just an absolute devastating situation for the clubhouse, where I think there's a perception here that there isn't a homelessness problem in Park City. And, you know, we had five unhoused members this past year through the winter. And I think it is a problem. It's just not as visible as you might see in other communities. But it is absolutely devastating and a cycle, because when you have when you are homeless, it's very difficult to keep down a stable job. And yet, if you don't have a job, you can't find housing. And so, you know, we all know someone who's been caught in that trap, and it's very easy to happen in a community like this with the housing prices and the cost of living that we have. It can happen really quickly.
Yeah, we should just clarify real quick, though. The clubhouse, I mean, it's a daily use function, even though it is a house. There is no housing there.
Yes, thank you for saying that. The name is really very difficult, challenging one. There is no housing. It's not zoned for residential use. Well, actually, we have a conditional use permit. It's daytime hours and programming, yeah. Some evening and weekend social programming. But no housing. So we had a challenge. Most clubhouses, there are 340 clubhouses around the world. Many have transitional housing for members. We do not. So our way of addressing that issue this year has been through financial support, rent assistance, but it was just something that was very challenging. So we are very grateful to have a short-term but impactful partnership with Deer Valley this summer. We are able to access their employee housing units for our homeless members or unhoused members who otherwise wouldn't qualify. So these are people who aren't yet holding down steady work. And we have access. We're able to provide the financial assistance to our members to be able to use those units. And while it's not long term, it is the first step. And I think it can give a member just enough stability to be able to, you know, address their recovery and get back to work. And hopefully then, you know, also we are working really hard, you know, trying to lean on some of our nonprofit partners like Mountainlands Community Housing Trust and Peace House and the Christian Center and so many others to see if we can raise our voices and have better advocacy, make sure this is still front and center, top of mind for city and county, that we not only need affordable housing, but we need deeply affordable housing, and we need transitional units units for people with disabilities or mental health challenges to make this community really whole and thriving.
So this workforce housing that Deer Valley has, what, just otherwise sitting empty at this time of year?
Yeah, I think they, a little bit, and they had a unit that they otherwise probably would be renovating right now, and they're holding off on some of that work in order to make space for our members. So, yeah. But yeah, it definitely would not be as available in the winter, which is why we're kind of scrambling to see what other opportunities we might be able to find.
All right. Well, Brent, Jen brought you along just to kind of talk about how that housing stability kind of impacts those that, you know, may have some mental health issues.
It's huge. Yeah, for me, it's been the difference of being able to think and move forward as compared to ruminate or obsessive, like, okay, I have to, but I can't, but I have to. It's that, you know, my personal issue is complicated in the sense that I need a CPAP machine. And if not, imagine yourself trying to get a good night's rest and being, you know, awakened several times an hour, and then wake up the next morning ready to go and conquer the world and to think clearly and to work your way through what is already a complicated and difficult situation. So having housing, having a place to, you know, I have access to a restroom, I can go, I can bathe, I can lay my clothes out, I can eat. And it's also not having to worry about imposing or calling attention to myself to the community. Because as much as I love the community, I don't want to call attention to myself being unhoused. Yeah, so it allows some dignity to return also, you know. And then all of that just sets me up for what are the goals that I'm working towards. And do I have the support that I need? And housing is so fundamental to that.
Yeah. I mean, how difficult is it out there, the housing market, to find something that you can afford?
Well, it's not just affording it. And it is very difficult, but you also have to look at that. I didn't, you know, for myself, I didn't intend to find myself in this situation. You know, I've had previous, you know, education and in, you know, good paying jobs and so on and so forth. It was just a cluster of situational, circumstantial things that led me to where I'm at. So having the money to make the deposit, to get things caught up on in other areas that you've already fallen unintentionally behind on is so difficult. So yes, because if you were a rental manager and I came to you and I didn't have $1,500 to put down, or I didn't have $125 for, you know, a fee or something like that, then those are they're gateways. I mean, you have to get through those gates to be able to get into the housing. And sometimes just getting through those initial gateways and getting, you know, and still sustaining yourself in daily life is it's very difficult.
Yeah. So this has been very beneficial.
Oh, it's been awesome.
You specifically.
Yes.
That's wonderful. Jen, let's move on. We got a lot of topics here. The employment, the clubhouse, as you mentioned, supports employment programs. And what's happening there on those fronts?
Yeah, sure. The culture of a clubhouse is that work is central to recovery, right? Mm-hmm. We think it, and it does. It builds confidence, it builds identity, it builds purpose. Brent used the word dignity, which I love. So we try and provide opportunities for members to work at the clubhouse as step one. You know, that kind of gives that sense of routine and meaning. But then we see ourselves as a launch pad, not a landing pad. So as soon as possible, we are working hard with members and members with staff and members to member peer support, getting them back into being a productive member of the community in the workforce. And we can provide support. A lot of our members are ready to return to work independently. They need very little support other than, you know, resume checks and some networking. Others need support, supported employment program that we have, which can be, you know, we had a member recently who returned to work as a small example at a fast food restaurant and was about to quit because he was challenged by not being able to make change in the register. And it was an issue where there was panic and doubt, self-doubt, and almost someone quitting, and then opened up to the clubhouse employment unit, and they made a relationship with the manager where they could explain what was happening and kind of shift the role and the responsibilities, and they ended up putting that member at a cash machine that is credit card only. I mean, small fixes, but just a little bit of having the support of someone to help you communicate the stress or the anxiety or the complication that your mental health may may have in you meeting that role, rather than panicking and running away. That's the type of support that the clubhouse can provide and does provide. And then transitional employment programs are even a little bit more hands-on. And we do have a nice relationship now with the Roadhouse restaurant, the formerly Squatters, there on 224, and we are just starting to look for, you know, placements to be able to place positions there at the Roadhouse Grills and those supported positions. So some progress there.
Yeah. I wanted to just touch on this. As we've reported, Summit County has entered into a six-month contract with the HMHI, Park City Behavioral Health Clinic, as it works out terms for a longer contract. Much of this is being done behind closed doors at this point, but why is this organization important for your community?
Sure, for the clubhouse and for the whole community. Let's see. I think, well, for us, the clubhouse just works much better when combined with traditional approaches to mental illness, which is medication and therapy. There has to be that holistic approach, right? And I think for our whole community, treating mental illness is absolutely critical, because otherwise you're dealing with the expensive fallout of mental illness, which the outcomes still are way too often hospitalization, incarceration, and, you know, suicide. There are just a lot of very tragic outcomes for people with mental health challenges when left untreated. So HMHI plays such a key role in this community. I think that the challenge, I'm glad I'm not Aaron Newman right now, because the challenge is real. I mean, the increase in use of mental health and the increased demand for mental health services is huge over the past many years. So, but investing in HMHI is very important. They serve a huge proportion of our membership. And I do like that now our members have that option of a more holistic approach. They can use HMHI for their treatment, and they can also be addressing their social isolation, addressing their employment and their housing and their education and all over the kind of the all of the other social determinants of their health through that partnership. So that is a really important relationship for us.
Okay, and want to make note that you have a fundraiser coming up at the end of the month on the 31st. You're sold out already, so is there...
Yeah, we are. We do have a wait list. We're very grateful to the executive chef, Michael Showers of High West, is going to be coming and putting on a really culinary experience there at the clubhouse, which is going to be fun. We only have 40 spaces. It's a small house. Mm-hmm. Invite anyone to come and see the clubhouse at some point so you can kind of visualize how that happens. But the fundraiser, we do have a wait list for, so reach out on our website or to me by email to get more information. We also have coming up next Friday, I think that's the 12th, we're going to be having a smaller event but open to the public, where we're going to be doing kind of a greenhouse dedication. We had a few generous donors over the past few years make possible a greenhouse in our backyard, and we're finally, the members themselves, it's been a nice addition to the work order day. We now are eating our own kale, we have beets, we have carrots, we have lettuce, we have spinach. So we're going to be doing a small greenhouse dedication event and luncheon next Friday, the 12th. Do need an RSVP for that. So you can always reach out to us. Information, contact information is on the website, or my email is jeno@summitcountyclubhouse.org.
Okay. And then the website, just summitcountyclubhouse.org.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what are the other ways, though, that you're raising money? I mean, besides this small fundraiser for the programs you're offering?
Yes. We're lucky over some nonprofits where we do have about 20% of our budget is covered by Medicaid reimbursement. Medicaid has deemed that this is psychosocial rehabilitation is beneficial and worth covering. So the rest of that that operating budget is covered through some grants and individual donors. And so we do that through Live PC. Give PC is a big part of our fundraising plan. We have this event in the summer that is sold out, thank goodness. And then we're just, you know, hitting the pavement. We're inviting community members into that clubhouse all the time, because I think that, you know, whereas a lot of nonprofits you can't see and sit down and have lunch with the people that you serve, clubhouse does have that advantage where you can walk through the door and see and feel the impact it has. So we're constantly just reaching out to community members, inviting them in, and hopefully seeing that they would understand the value that this service is bringing to the community.
Okay. I got to leave it there. But Jen and Brent, thanks so much for your time
this morning.
Leslie.
Thank you, appreciate it.
On the phone now with an update from Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Hey, wanted to bring up the fact that you are taking reservations now for next month's annual Blue Sky Bash. Tell us about this.
That's right. Early bird tickets are currently on sale for a couple of more weeks. So it's a great time to gather your friends and come to one of the summer's most fun events, I think, and perhaps the most fun way to help us save open space. The Blue Sky Bash happens up at the arena at the lodges at Blue Sky. We've been having it there for about 8 years now, so some people might be familiar with the event. We really have a beautiful cocktail hour out on the patio. Our friends at Hawkwatch International come and bring some raptors. We're expecting, I think, a couple of eagles this year. And it's just a great opportunity to have some community and to celebrate the work that has been done and we continue to do. It's followed by a brief live auction and a paddle raise and a little bit of a discussion about how Summit Land Conservancy is really able to leverage a lot of federal money and bring it in to save the open spaces in the Wasatch Back. But I think the really important message here is that we can't access that money. Like, we get the awards, but we would have to send it back to Washington, D.C. if we weren't able to rally support from individuals in the community. And that's what the Blue Sky Bash does for us. It really allows people to come out, have a great time, a little bit more about some of our current projects, and really celebrate all of that great work that we've done together with so many partners, and then participate in continuing that work going forward.
Okay, once again, that's happening August 9th there at Blue Sky Ranch, and you're actually providing transportation as part of the ticket price?
It's Friday, August 9th. I like to point out that it is a Friday, August 9th. And we do provide a shuttle. We are charging a small fee this year for the shuttle, just to make sure that we get a real accurate count of the people who actually are going to use it. Because if we don't, then we have more shuttle than we need.
Yeah. Okay.
It's all available on our website, which is wesaveland.org. There's a little more information about kind of the event and how it happens, and that's where you can get tickets also.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the property that you are trying to save now, and I guess really close to getting those conservation easements on.
That's correct. So, you know, in the next few months, we hope to save almost 10,000 acres. We have projects that have been already awarded funding from the federal government. Some of them have been funded by Summit County. And we're really excited about this. But again, this is where, you know, we need the last funding from individuals to get these projects across the finish line. So it's sort of the last dollar in. Looking at about $16 million of easement value. And, you know, we need maybe $200,000 from individuals. So we're really leveraging people's money and saving some really significant open spaces. One of the properties is in Echo Canyon. So if you drive out of Park City up towards Evanston and you see all those big red rocks on the side of the cliffs, those are part of those are on this 4,200 acre property that we're going to be saving in Echo Canyon.
Okay, you've got some more outdoor fun plan. Tell us about these activities.
That's right. Lots of fun ways to get out and connect with the open spaces that we've all protected together in the summertime. So on July 10th and 20th, we have hops hikes. Those start at 6 p.m. Again, sign up on our website, wesaveland.org. There's no cost to attend those events, but we do limit the number of people who are on the trails with us because it can get a little crowded. So we do also have a wait list. Sometimes those do get filled up. So if you are interested in those, again, July 10th and 20th, we go up, we hike the trails, we look for hops that are growing up, as you know, on the hillsides. In August, we'll harvest those, and then our friends up at Top of Maine, formerly Wasatch Brew Pub, make them into a delicious beer. And then also on July 26th, we have a moonlight adventure. Again, check out our website to find out where that's meeting and also to sign up. Again, that's free. And that one is out in the moon, in the moonlight. So it's a little bit of a different view of some of the open spaces that we protect.
Okay. Let's see. People do need to register for those events, though.
That's right. They are free. We ask people to go to wesaveland.org and sign up. Again, because we, you know, we have certain caps and limits as to how many people can attend. And, of course, we need people to sign a waiver.
Okay. And finally, what's going on with the conservation burial efforts?
Right. So we've been working with the city of Oakley for a few months now on creating a small sanctuary on city-owned land that would be for public access and trails. It would look very much like a natural public open space area where people can also be buried. Conservation burial is, we sometimes call it pioneer burial. It's really what humans have done with their past loved ones for centuries, which is to wrap them in a simple shroud and place them gently in the earth. It's also kind of the best thing to do with our carbon once we're no longer using it. It's clean, it's safe. The earth, it's you know, we are also creatures of this planet, and it is really how the planet is best able to reuse the resources that we've been walking around with. We've been looking, Summit Land Conservancy has been looking for a site to do this for a number of years, in part because we feel like it would be something that would appeal to people here in the region. But we need to find multiple ways to save open spaces. You know, sometimes we work with municipalities to create an open space like Brown Valley. Sometimes we work with developers to put a conservation easement on the open space component of their development, like King's Crown. And sometimes, of course, we work with private landowners who want to protect their farms and ranches. And so this is a little bit of a hybrid kind of situation. The city of Oakley is looking at doing something to protect about 100 acres or so, or maybe something around that, of a property that they already own up on Pinyon Lane. And this is just sort of an interesting way to do that without costing the city any money, basically.
Okay. And when do you actually hope to make this a reality?
The city of Oakley has had a couple of discussions in public, and they want to have an open space, an open house about the open space in August. And at some point after that, we hope they'll make the decision to go ahead and go forward. We're already starting to do some site analysis to make sure it is an appropriate site for a conservation cemetery. Conservation cemetery is fundamentally different than a regular cemetery. There's no lawn, there's no headstone, there's no fertilizer. Bodies are prepared in a very natural way. And so, you know, there are certain benefits and restrictions, but also, if you go to a normal cemetery, a portion of your fees that you pay, you know, go to maintaining lawns and fertilizer and sprinklers and things like that. In this situation, those fees instead go to protect the land, restore the land, and preserve more land in the region, in the area. So that's what conservation burial is all about.
Yeah, and what kind
of... So people will be able to get more information in August, and I hope in my August open space update I'll be able to give you more details.
All right. All right. We'll leave it there then. Thank you, Cheryl.
Great. Thank you.
Cheryl Fox is the CEO of the Summit Land Conservancy. The Park City School District proposing a new cell phone policy, and it's looking for community feedback. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that it would prohibit cell phone use during school hours.
Based on conversations with staff, students, and parents, the district determined cell phone use should be limited during school hours so students can stay engaged. This is reflected in a new proposed cell phone policy. If the policy is passed, students would not be allowed to use phones during school hours. Students would have to keep their devices in a secure place out of sight during the day, like in a locker, backpack, or other storage container the school provides. However, there are exceptions. Some students need cell phones to monitor health concerns or for translation purposes, and as long as the need is documented in a student's individualized plan, they can continue to use a phone. The policy was presented at a board meeting June 18th, and Board Vice President Wendy Crossland hopes the community will provide feedback.
I would encourage people to look at that and submit comments if they're thoughtful, concerned, have ideas about it. Since this is a new policy and something we're trying to move forward along.
The district has engaged with staff, parents, and students in conversations about cell phone use in schools throughout the past few months. During a panel in May, Treasure Mountain Junior High Principal Caleb Fine talked about how difficult it can be to manage cell phone use in a classroom and how much it can be a distraction. A second panel in June discussed more about the negative effects of social media. A parent and student shared personal experiences of online bullying and it leading to an eating disorder. Fine even said social media platform Snapchat was his, quote, version of the devil. The panel and many in the audience agreed it would be best to delay children's access to smartphones for as long as possible and have a no cell phone policy in schools. The district also sent a cell phone use survey to staff, parents, and students in May, which received over 900 responses. While the results are not yet available, Superintendent Jill Gilday said during a June board meeting there was a lot of support for a no cell phone policy.
There does seem to be good support, especially at junior high level, for trying to do some more untethering the kids. What we're finding in the research and in practice is we're very overprotective of our students in real life and what we're allowing them to do from an independent standpoint, but we're very underprotective in what's occurring online.
That's based on national research and local trends the district has seen. The district board will have a second reading and consider passing the policy at its next meeting, August 20th. The community can comment during the board meeting or share their thoughts via email at communication@pcschools.us. Christine Weller, KPCW News.